You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, good afternoon. Welcome along to the Thursday Wire. Ko Stuart Somanlan toku ingoa. It's the 23rd of May. Wonderful to have your company. We've hopefully got a packed show, I think. Joining me in studio, my producers Liv and Grace. How are you both?
Yeah, really good.
Good. Yeah.
How are you, Stuart?
Oh, everything's going perfectly. So I'm great. Anything that's caught your eye in the news this week that's particularly exciting?
I mean, obviously, the budget's exciting.
A week out from the budget today.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah. That's, you know, ramping up.
What's a well-being budget, do you know?
Well, we'll find out today, won't we?
Will we?
Well-being.
Well, we hope so. Anything on the show today that you think is, like, really exciting for people listening at home?
Well, I mean, I personally think it's quite interesting about the Reserve Bank calling for more holding capital in national banks, which basically is about...
Rod Oram will explain.
Yeah, making sure that we can withstand fluctuations in the economy. So we'll hear about that.
Well, coming up on the show today, in just a moment, the Privacy Commissioner chats to me about how landlords might be breaching the Privacy Act when asking for certain information in tenancy applications. After that, Liv talks to political commentator Rod Oram about exactly what we were just talking about, the Reserve Bank's plans to increase National Bank's holding capital. Then Labor Minister Stuart Nash is here to fill in for Andrew Little. We're talking about the budget a week out from next week's announcements. Then Grace chats to BFM reporter Justin Wong in Paris about Brexit developments overnight. And finally, she speaks with Forest and Bird spokesperson Jeff Key about the zero carbon bill passing its first reading. So that's all coming up on the show in the next hour, but I want to know what you think. Tuku pātui mai, you can text me on 5395. Why am I? Call us in studio on 309 3879. Or you can tweet us at 95BFM News on our Twitter account today, our weekly poll. Do you know what a wellbeing budget is? Let me know on Twitter or send me your thoughts, because I mean, shouldn't all budgets be wellbeing? I don't know. 309 3879 or 5395. Our country's privacy watchdog has this week released a new set of guidelines revealing the information that landlords should not be able to ask prospective tenants for during the application process. Some of them seem obvious, but some of them might surprise you if you've been house hunting in recent years. Privacy Commissioner John Edwards spoke with me this morning, and I started by asking him what information landlords have reportedly been asking for.
Sure. Well, we've found a number of tenants coming to us and saying, hey, look, my landlord wants to know, you know, what I have for breakfast, and it just feels a bit uncomfortable. So we thought we would try and help out by setting some broad parameters, saying, you know, as a tenant, you can expect always to be asked for this kind of stuff. Sometimes you might need to provide this sort of information, but if you're asked for other bits and pieces, you know, you might want to have a, you know, ask the landlord what they're up to. So things like sports and hobbies, your employment status, your banking history, proof of insurance, those kinds of things.
Even your age, I saw on that list. I mean, that seems something that you just obviously put on an application.
Well, yeah, I mean, what we're saying is that at a pre-tenancy stage, there are some bits of information that a landlord simply doesn't need. When you come to sign up the tenancy agreement, they may want to see proof of ID, which would include, you know, might also have the age on it. But, you know, if you're talking about a marketplace for residential tenancies where 30 people are applying for a property, if you're hoovering up all that sensitive information about all those people, that could be excessive. Once you've decided who your preferred tenant is, you might be justified in saying, well, actually, you know, for legal reasons, I need to know that you're over 18. Can you show me some proof? That's not date of birth. That's just, I am over 18.
So how severe could these privacy breaches be? Would they lead to any form of liability, or is it sort of just a, you know, a slap on the wrist?
Well, at this stage, there's, you know, if a person suffered harm because of an overcollection, yeah, it could lead to some liability. There could be damages awarded to a tenant who's actually harmed by a landlord's attempt to collect this kind of information. When the new privacy law is passed next year, I will be able to issue compliance notices. So if tenants say, look, here's a particular property manager that's always asking for this really intrusive stuff, we might actually decide to help them out by issuing a compliance notice saying you can't do that anymore.
The problem I sort of have with this is, I mean, I've encountered most of those things before in applying for applications, and I didn't realise that they were, you know, breach of my privacy, and I probably should have. But say I did, I probably still would have included that because these are the people deciding if I have somewhere to live. I mean, what about people who are in, there will be people who are in a far more, you know, difficult situation than I am when it comes to housing. They're probably just going to give the information if it means they might get a roof over their head, aren't they?
Yeah, there's certainly a power imbalance here, and that's one of the reasons we're trying to support people to stick up for themselves. But, you know, even if they don't feel able to, even if they give over all the information that the landlord asks, you know, once they're comfortable in the lounge there, they can send that stuff to us. They don't need to give us their name, and we can go out to that landlord and say, hang on, this looks a bit dodgy to us.
Is there going to be a more intense system put in place? Is there something that's being looked at where this may no longer end up being a problem in the future? You know, is there going to be more stricter guidelines enforced?
Well, I hope so. Certainly, I know that officials are looking at the Residential Tenancies Act, so they may be having a look at this area as well. But when the new Privacy Act passes next year, as I say, we'll have more tools to be able to enforce the standards that we expect.
How does our tenancy system stack up against the rest of the world, taking into account that we are going to have those new privacy that new privacy legislation in force next year? Is it still going to be, you know, is it going to be on the same level as other countries?
That's a good question. I don't know. We haven't really done a survey of other jurisdictions, but I'll let you in on a little secret. This guidance that we've issued, we kind of stole from another jurisdiction. So they had this idea of the green light, amber light, red light, notifying what information could be collected in that jurisdiction. So we've thought, well, that's a good idea, a really easy way of conveying that information to landlords and tenants. We'll borrow it and adapt it for the New Zealand situation.
Just last week, a really horrific example of sort of what we're talking about here, three tenants were turned away because the landlord believed that Indians are dirty. I mean, what do you think when you hear stories like this come out?
What I think is that we have a real problem in this country and that we need to address it and to ensure that the laws are enforced. Now, it's unlawful to deny someone a tenancy based on their ethnicity. So, you know, these are not just privacy issues, these are human rights issues, and I would hope that that landlord came to the attention of the Human Rights Commission.
Does some of it come down to a culture that we have in New Zealand around discrimination in terms of tenancies?
I don't know. I haven't seen research on that. I don't know the answer to that. What I'm trying to do is to help landlords stay out of trouble by not over-collecting information and at the same time providing some support for tenants who, as you say, are in a vulnerable position. And if they've got a piece of paper from us that they can say to the landlord, hey, look, the Privacy Commissioner thinks your form's a bit dodgy, then that might help them.
Do you think that a landlord might see that piece of paper and go, OK, we're going to go with another tenant?
Well, that is a risk, but as I say, there's no reason for the tenant to take that burden on themselves. Mm-hmm. If they want to bring stuff to our attention, you know, maybe they weren't going to get the tenancy anyway. So after they've been denied, they might want to make a complaint to us.
That was Privacy Commissioner John Edwards speaking with me this morning about those new guidelines. What do you two think? Is that surprising? Have you had to apply for applications included this sort of information? Because I know I definitely have.
I live in Auckland, so I've never had to do that. But I know a lot of my friends who have applied have had to, you know, put up those personal details, which is quite interesting. I thought it was just part of the process.
Yeah.
I've actually never had to go through that process before, so that's quite interesting.
Because I remember when it must have been at the end of my time in the halls, we had this like seminar on flatting, and we were told by older students, always include bank statements because they love knowing that you can afford to pay for your flat. And so like I put together all these like packages when I was applying for flats, and I had like all this information I probably shouldn't have had. Anyway, no, it's interesting stuff. I'd be interested to know if anyone else out there thinks similarly on that.
Liv, what have you got for us?
Yeah, so the Reserve Bank is calling for national banks to hold more capital. However, the banks are unhappy with the decision, claiming that holding more capital will make them more expensive to run and have negative effects on customers. I spoke to economic journalist Rod Oram about the implications of the Reserve Bank's plans and began by asking, why exactly is the Reserve Bank calling for them to hold more capital?
It believes that given the big cyclical and structural issues ahead for the global economy, and we're not immune to that, it's important that banks are very strong and very well capitalized. And so that's why it's arguing that it's necessary for them to increase their capital. And that's the fundamental reason behind it.
So why exactly are banks against this?
They are arguing that they're perfectly well capitalized, but on the other hand, they have their assets, i.e. their loans, very heavily concentrated in two particular sectors, one being the housing market and the other one being dairy farms. And the proportions vary slightly from main bank to main bank. So the banking system could probably cope with a very nasty setback in one of those, and the odds on that happening are reasonably long. But the odds on both of them happening close to each other or in conjunction with each other are even longer. But that is something to worry about a bit with our banks. The main banks are also opposed to this because they're arguing that their systems are perfectly adequate for judging what sort of capital they need. But in fact, at the moment, they have a very big advantage over small lenders in that small lenders have to just hold reserves which are based on a formula dictated by the Reserve Bank, and that major banks have some scope to weight the risks of capital and therefore how much capital is needed. And so being able to have some discretion over how much capital they require is a benefit to them because it means that they have slightly lower lending costs than small lending institutions. So if there is a major reset of that, they might lose that competitive advantage.
Right. So do you think that the impact would be as drastic as national banks are suggesting if they were to have to adopt this capital holding plan?
The argument is that if more capital is required, then the banks are going to have to put up the interest rates they charge to compensate the banks for holding more capital. And because if you have less capital, you're able to support more loans, more business on the capital you have. But if you increase that, that cost of capital increases. I am skeptical about that personally because the banks should be competitive amongst themselves. And the argument that the Reserve Bank gives or makes, and I would fall into that, you know, that side of the argument too, is that the competitive pressures between the banks will make sure that those lending costs don't rise, or if they do, it's not going to be very significant.
Right.
And so I think this is a real test of bank competitiveness. There's another really good reason for doing this. Our banking system is extremely unusual. There's only a handful of other countries like this in the world, where if you have money on deposit at the bank, those deposits are not insured by the government or the banking system. So if a bank gets into difficulty, it's then going to be the depositors who help keep that bank afloat. And so this is a new system that our Reserve Bank designed and put in place after the global financial crisis. But it means that if you, say, had $100,000 in the bank, you would be forced to give up some part of that. We don't know the exact sum would vary from bank to bank and the severity of the problem. And that money would then go as new capital towards the bank to help keep it running. So this is called open resolution. So the bank remains open while these capital issues are resolved. And I think that very few New Zealanders realize that that's a potential liability they have with their deposits. Now, again, I want to stress that there's no signs of any of our banks are anywhere near any trouble, which would trigger that sort of thing. But this is very much about ensuring the banking system is ready to cope with far greater dislocations and problems should they arise.
Obviously, the Reserve Bank's also cut the official cash rate, so that's lowering interest rates. And assuming to, you know, try and stimulate a slowing economy, how does this play into everything going on?
it helps in one sense because it's helping keep interest rates low. And therefore, if banks' cost of capital rises, then the rise wouldn't be so great. So there is something of a connection between the two. But in fact, the debates and decisions to be made and arguments to be had over bank reserves, it's got some long way to play out yet. Whereas this OCR reduction at the beginning of the month has an immediate impact. And it is really significant. It's in terms of how unusual it is. We're at a time of long-running growth and record employment levels. And this is a time where you would expect there would be a fair amount of inflation in the economy. And therefore, the banks would be raising interest rates, trying to slow things down and to try to take that inflationary pressure out. But we're in this extraordinary situation, which is now going back more than 10 years to the global financial crisis and its aftermath, that inflation seems impossible to kindle, to get, for actually bubble up in the economy. So therefore, the Reserve Bank, in essence, is lowering its interest rate, its official cash rate, because it's hoping to keep economic activity high in the hope that inflation will just nudge up a little bit and get it into the target range that it's supposed to achieve.
Right.
Because it negotiates with each government a number of its operating parameters, and one of them is its target rate for inflation. And for more than 10 years now, because of this very low inflation globally, this central bank, but many all the others around the world, have all been missing their inflation targets.
The government's currently in a budget surplus. Do you think maybe if we increased our expenditure that this kind of caution would have to be so necessary?
It's a really interesting question because with interest rates so low, the Reserve Bank's ability to give much sort of direction or nudge the economy in any way is very limited. So it's actually very helpful to it if the government has, through its spending, a bit of a fiscal stimulus to the economy. But balanced against that, Grant Robertson, as finance minister, believes it's fundamentally important that Labour be seen, a Labour-led government be seen as a very, you know, conservative, rigorous, financially disciplined government. And that's why he's not prepared to to change those settings. My personal view on that is that we do have a great deal to do in New Zealand. Interest rates are very low. Large chunks of money in infrastructure bonds and things to help us do some things that we need getting done, I think, are very important. It begs the question if you've then got a construction industry that can deliver it, but that's the other part one needs to work on. But my sense of it is that it would be good to have somewhat more investment than we're getting out of the government at the moment.
That was political commentator Rod Oram chatting with our producer, Liv. We love Rod, don't we? He's very good.
He's so good to talk to.
Something that was interesting that he said there is about Grant Robertson wanting to, his party, his government wanting to maintain that image of kind of conservatism in terms of
responsibility.
It comes out when I talk with Stuart Nash in our interview, but he kind of talks about how National's perceived as the managerial party, Labour less so because they basically, in terms of well-being budget, they want to spend the money, right? That's what they set out to do. I don't know if I agree that Grant Robertson's kind of trying to portray a sort of more conservative image in terms of
the economy. This morning, he actually announced that they were scrapping their original spending, and now they're going to about 15 to 20% of GDP. So that's going to be interesting to come out over the next week or so. And a little bit more, around that context of capital holding, the Reserve Bank has been allowing the big four banks, we're talking ANZ, ASB, BNZ and Westpac, to set their own capital holding levels after the financial crisis, whereas the small banks have always been quite heavily regulated in turn of capital holding. So I think this is also why it's coming up quite... It's quite an interesting time because the Reserve Bank is obviously saying, hey, we need to start doing something about, we're looking at how much capital you're holding and we don't think you're actually doing enough or holding on to enough. So, yeah, it's all in to protect the consumer, though. So,
as always, well, if you've got any feedback at all, remember, of course, 5395 is the number to text, 309 3879 if you want to call in. We've also got our poll up on Twitter as well. Time now, though, to take a break. Coming up in just a moment, we're a week out from Budget Day 2019. I speak with Labour Minister Stuart Nash next.
Yeah. Anything else?
Yeah. When your team needs filling up, they can't be satisfied. Their appetite needs servicing, so open wide.
Could we outsource this one?
Great idea.
Cater Station are holding a competition to find their new jingle. Do you have what it takes? If you do, you could be walking away with a cool $1,000 cash. Find out more. Go to 95bfm.com or text jingle to 5395.
I know where you were last night.
Craig, it's not...
Am I not deep enough? I can be emotional. I can break the fourth wall.
Wink.
I know we don't have the same history together.
But I love both of you.
No! Make a choice. Me or theatre.
Live for drama? Take some stage direction from our resident theatre expert. What's on and what's good on the Auckland stage? 9 a.m. every Friday on Breakfast. Stage direction with Johanna Cosgrove. Brought to you by the Vic Devonport.
Welcome back to The Wire. No texts have come through.
So sad.
It's the budget. Surely, you know, it'd be good to know, is there anything that you want to see in the budget? Is there anything you're expecting? Something I talk about in just a moment. We may as well just move on to it. It's time now for this.
Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labour MP Andrew Little.
Except this week it's not Andrew Little. Unfortunately, the Minister's mother has passed away this week, and from all of us at 95BFM, we pass on our condolences, and we really do hope he'll be back on the show with us in the near future. This week, we've got the Minister for Police, Fisheries, Revenue and Small Business, Stuart Nash. He's talking to me about the government's wellbeing budget. We're a week out from Budget Day. Are there going to be any surprises? Plus, a new report has revealed Parliament is a toxic workplace with a systemic bullying problem. What does Minister Nash make of all of that? Have a listen. Good morning, Minister. Nice to talk to you.
Good morning, Stuart. How are you?
I'm good. Now, just to distinguish, different spelling. That's how we can get away with the two Stuarts.
Well, that's okay. I won't tell if you don't.
Firstly, I'd like to turn to the budget. We're a week out from Budget Day, which is always an exciting day for us in the media. Can you tell me, what is a wellbeing budget?
Okay, well, it's basically a different way of looking at how the government prioritises resources and money and what it invests in. So in the past, what sort of happened is Cabinet has agreed a broad set of priorities, and these have guided the budget decisions. There's been a heavy emphasis on measuring GDP. So, you know, in the past we've said if we've got a strong economy, things are going well. What we've done this time is we've taken a much more holistic approach and said, okay, of course GDP is an important measure, but also the health and well-being of our communities is also really important. You know, we used to hear this term rockstar economy, where we had great rates of growth, but there are huge swathes of our population that were going backwards. So this is sort of looking at intergenerational well-being, if that sort of makes sense, as opposed to just economic measures.
So are not all budgets well-being budgets then?
No, not at all. This is a different approach. Let me give you one example in my area. So in my area as Minister of Police, I've worked very closely with Andrew Little as the Minister of Justice, Kelvin Davis as the Minister of Corrections, Jan Logie as the Undersecretary for Domestic and Sexual Violence, Apito Williams-Seo in his role as Associate Justice. And we've had a look at a holistic approach to the justice sector and said, okay, in terms of all the budget we control in our ministerial responsibilities, where is it best to invest so we can have a real prevention focus, as opposed to Kelvin in corrections just saying, okay, I need a prison, so I need a whole lot of money to build that prison. Me saying, okay, I need a whole lot of police. And Andrew saying, I need more, you know, judges. And then we're going into a contestable process with the Minister of Finance. So we sort out beforehand what we think is the best mix to really drive change in the justice sector and present a sort of consolidated and coordinated budget bid. So I hope that sort of makes sense, but it really is a lot more of a holistic approach to how we view how we spend taxpayers' money.
So when you say you don't just need a whole lot of police, you kind of do, though, don't you? Aren't you looking for 1,800?
I know I do, but it's not an isolation of everything else. So, you know, one of our main goals is to reduce Maori recidivism, for example. One of our major goals is to reduce family violence. I mean, police attend over 130,000 cases every year of family violence. So we work with Jan, I work with Kelvin and Andrew to say, okay, in terms of the programs we're running and the pilots that we've got out there and the, you know, and the initiatives we want to try, how best do we invest our resources that are going to allow my police to take on the prevention model, Kelvin to reduce the prison numbers, Jan Logie to say, okay, this is the best outcome in terms of reducing sexual and domestic violence. So there are a whole lot of really important conversations, and in the end we come up with a package in the justice sector that we think is best to optimise that whole process, if that makes sense, as opposed to me just saying Kel doesn't need his prison or Jan doesn't need money for domestic and sexual violence, I need my police in isolation of everything else. It's really a joined up approach, I suppose, is the best way to describe it.
So are you happy with what you've gained for your portfolios in the budget?
I'd always like more, of course. but you know, I'm happy with the direction of travel that we're taking as a government. And when I say that, of course, you know, a strong economy is important, because when businesses are doing well, they create wealth, they create jobs. But it's also just as important that that our communities are seeing benefit in what we are doing. So it really is a joined up holistic approach to the way we look at the health and well-being of the country as a whole, as opposed to just a strong economic focus around GDP.
After next week's budget, there's only one more in this term. Do you think you've upheld your obligations to New Zealand First and the Green Party?
Yeah, and that's a really good question. What we have tried to do is say, okay, we couldn't do everything in the first budget, which was last year, obviously. The second budget is the second in three, as you've highlighted, in terms of changing the whole settings. And the third one, I think, will be the final budget in terms of delivering everything we've promised to the people of New Zealand. It is, you know, I'm the first to admit that what we have tried to do has really been aspirational, certainly in my area. I know Grant Robertson, as the Minister of Finance, is always aspirational. And so, you know, what's tended to happen in the past, and history will bear this out, is that national governments tend to be managerial, whereas Labor governments or Labor-led governments have tended to be sort of evolutionary, if not revolutionary, in the way we do things. And, you know, sometimes that has a completely different approach to just saying, okay, things are going well, we're going to be incremental. We've tried to do things a lot differently, but we believe that that'll provide a better outcome for all New Zealanders.
So by the end of next year's budget, you reckon you will have ticked off all of those boxes for the two parties that you work alongside?
Well, what we will try to do is certainly put in place a number of processes that will allow us to achieve what we want to achieve. I mean, we're always working closely with our coalition and support partners, and it's not just at budget time. I mean, you know, in my areas, my fishing portfolio, I work very closely with the Minister of Conservation, Eugenie Sage. I work very closely with Winston Peters. In fact, the Deputy Prime Minister and myself are off to the Cook Islands to talk about fisheries very soon. And so it's not just at budget time we come together and determine, you know, what the state of the government looks like. It's sort of a business as usual day to day occurrence. But, you know, we won't have built 100,000 houses, of course, but we will have put the processes in place which will allow us to achieve that. So I think it's changing the fundamental settings of how government does things, and I think that will put us in really good stead heading into the future.
One of your obligations to New Zealand First is to investigate a rural volunteer police force. What's happened to that announcement?
Well, what we've done is we've had a look at the difference that rolling out 1,800 police will make to our community. So what happened is Ron Mark in opposition, who was their New Zealand's first police spokesperson, and I did a lot of work around what was happening to policing in the rural and provincial New Zealand. And numbers were being cut, gangs were taking control, methamphetamine was rampant, and thought, okay, what's the best way to do this? So the rural constabulary idea was New Zealand First idea. But after sitting down and saying, hey, you know what, if we can actually roll out these 1,800 police, that will really make a big difference. You know, rural New Zealand really did suffer through cuts to road policing, for example. The last government cut 111 road policing. We increased those by July last year. So it's not just saying, hey, we're here to service the big cities. We're here to service the whole country. And so that's, you know, we just think rolling out 1,800 more police into rural and provincial New Zealand, as well as the big cities, will probably negate the need for a separate constabulary.
But we haven't got those 1,800 yet either, so are we going to even get to helping the rural regions out with those police numbers at all?
Oh, absolutely. So far since we've been in government, there's over 1,300 men and women who have graduated out of police college, and that equates to about 650 more police over and above numbers when we came into government. And if you consider that between 2012 and 2017, so the last 5 years of the previous government, police numbers actually fell by 70. And that was at a point where gangs were becoming more organised, methamphetamine was out of control, crime resolution rates were dropping. And so and police officers were feeling less satisfied with the work they were doing. And they said in their surveys that they just weren't meeting the expectation. Over 60% said they weren't meeting the expectation they were making to the public, and over 60%, and this is in the 2017 survey, said that they had an undue level of workplace stress. And so we're addressing this in a way that no government ever has in the past. But, you know, we'll get there. We also, of course, had the Provincial Growth Fund, which was a massive economic boost and is turning out to be to rural and regional New Zealand. So there are a lot of initiatives that we think will make the lives of provincial and rural New Zealanders a lot better than they were beforehand.
I'd like now to turn to that review into bullying in Parliament this week, which some quite major revelations in that about MPs and staffers across the board. Are you a bully, Minister?
No, I'm not. It's not how I conduct my life or manage my office in any way, shape or form. In fact, I have no time for bullying. I never did. You know, from my school days all the way through to different jobs and roles I've held, I think that cowards bully people.
Do you know any MPs who you think might be bullies, might be the ones referenced in that report?
Well, I don't know the MPs. We're making an assumption that some of the very serious allegations were MPs. They could well have been senior staffers. I've seen some behaviour that's made me feel uncomfortable, but nothing of a sexual assault nature, and certainly nothing of a serious sexual assault nature that that has really captured the imagination of the media. But that sort of behaviour is totally unacceptable in my view. It doesn't matter what position you're in. And you know, some people say, well, it's a stressful job. Well, that is no excuse. New Zealanders work in stressful jobs every single day up and down this country. And there is never any excuse for bullying, but certainly we've got to be intolerant of any sort of sexual assault.